Buy a Bugmobile.
Buy a Buffum.
Buy a Pope Hartford.
Rigs that run. A car without a weak spot. No noise but the wind.
Buy a Bates and keep your dates.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, May 26, 1946, we present the 28th in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
Cinderella on Wheels.
This is the true fairy tale sounding story of the greatest industry in the greatest industrial nation in the world.
Born in an old dark shack, turned loose in the world with scoffs and jeers, this Cinderella lived and prospered.
Changed the face of a nation and the lives of its people. And now, in the year of its lusty golden jubilee, this is an account of
Cinderella on Wheels.
This is Robert St. John in New York. Today, by force of circumstance, I am a part-time pedestrian. But I'm not alone, not by millions, and I'm not talking about the railroad strike. My voice is part of that coast-to-coast host of petitioners which daily faces toward the Mecca which lies in Michigan and pleads for a car. O mighty city, give us our FOB Detroit. To mark the 50th anniversary of automobile manufacture, the National Hour tells the fabulous Horatio Alger story of that industry. From Detroit, to aid and abet in the telling of our story, we shall be joined by George Romney of the Automobile Manufacturers Association, and from New York, Mr. J. Frank Duryea, who with his brother Charles built the first motor car in Springfield, Massachusetts, in 1892-93.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington, where at the moment the owner of a new car is as socially prominent as a cabinet member. Now, this statement isn't quite as far-fetched as it may seem, for within the 50 years of its life in this country, the automobile was a revolution on wheels. It changed our way of living, of dressing, of amusing ourselves, of strutting our stuff. And all that is part of the story. And for the comment of a sociologist, we shall hear from Professor Lee Emerson Dietz of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology of Hunter College, New York. We are standing by.
Now, we turn the key in the ignition and step on the starter of our story. This is the sound of revolution, the greatest and most peaceful sound in our country. The seeds of this revolution were sown in 1859, when oil was first drilled from the earth in Titusville, Pennsylvania.
The kerosene we get from oil, why, the whole country's buying enough to sail boats in it.
Sure, but this other byproduct, there's so much of it, and it's all worthless. I wish somebody could find some use for this stuff, this gasoline.
Seven years later, there was war in the United States, and the troops of General Grant were advancing toward the Mississippi. On a Michigan farm, a son was born to a family named Ford, and that son was christened Henry. And an American in Paris wrote a letter home.
A reputable engineer named Lenoir has just invented a hydrocarbon engine that works. I have seen it. The power is supplied by that same oil byproduct that you've been dumping into the river.
The news slowly made its way through America, and there were men who reacted to it, well, like a coffee percolator reacts to a hot flame. For every respectable American village had a church, a community pump, an atheist, and an inventor. An inventor in Arcadia, Florida, put aside his work on a machine that would transmute base metals into gold and went to work on a new project. In Portland, Maine, in Omaha, Nebraska, in Springfield, Massachusetts, in Sisterville, West Virginia, in San Francisco, California, the inventors, the tinkerers, the machine mad, they all went to work.
Ain't she about in a dog's age, Jake?
Nope.
What are you inventing now?
A wagon.
A wagon?
Yep.
Where are you going to put the horse?
Won't need a horse.
What are you going to put on it, sails?
Nope.
What's going to make it go?
An engine.
Leroy! Leroy!
Huh? Oh, is that you, Bess?
You know what time it is.
Oh, shucks, I guess I sort of got carried away by my work.
Well, carry yourself right out of this filthy barn and into the house and to bed.
Oh, please, Bess, I'll be through soon.
Through? That's what you told me 6 months ago.
Well, I meant I'll be through for the night.
And I mean through for good. What's all this fur, all these days and nights of work? I'm tired of telling folks you're always busy inventing.
But I've explained it to you so many times, Bess. A man in Germany has made a bicycle that's propelled by a motor.
What of it?
Well, if that's so, then I can use the same principle to drive a carriage.
And if you do find the way, who wants it? Who'll spend as much as a dollar for it? Tell me, who?
Oh, all right, Bess, I'm coming.
At the end of the century, we were a farming nation. Almost two-thirds of our then 63 million population lived on farms and in farm areas. In the South, only New Orleans had a population of more than 100,000. And the rural Americans made their living with the aid of 18 million horses and mules. And at the end of the century, few Americans realized it, and certainly none of the horses and mules, but their number was up and they were on their way out. The revolution was started, and it was to change our lives all the way from women's dresses through manners and morals and finance and national politics.
In the year 1891, during a summer slump in the bicycle business in Chicopee, Massachusetts, Charles E. Duryea and his brother Frank set about designing and constructing a gasoline motor powerful enough to propel a vehicle. And one day in the one-room office of Chicopee's only newspaper.
Say, Mr. Prentice, you got any more copy you want me to set up in type? I'd like to close this form.
Just a minute, Lem. Say, Arthur.
Yeah, what is it?
That story about the Duryea horseless carriage. You want to print it?
Why not? Give our subscribers something to laugh about.
I don't find it especially amusing.
A gasoline carriage replacing the horse? Why, that's crazier than anything Jules Verne ever dreamed.
Two years later, in 1895, on a snowy Thanksgiving day, the Duryea four-horsepower horseless carriage won America's first automobile race over a 54-mile course from Jackson Park on Chicago's south side all the way to Evanston and back. 16 cars entered the race. Several of them were electric cars. Only two finished. The winning time, 10 hours and 48 minutes, for 54 miles.
Mr. Duryea, did the engine on your wagon give you any trouble at all?
Not a bit, mister. We had power to spare at all places and had no occasion to get out and push. Our motor worked right through. I can drive it right into the stable now and leave it. There'll be no muddy unhitching, no cleaning, no feeding. Long live the motor wagon.
On that day in Chicago, a small but explosive bit of history was made. For reminiscences of that page in history, we have invited the winner of that race to our studio. At our microphone here in New York is Mr. J. Frank Duryea, who 53 years ago, with his brother, created what the Smithsonian Institution and the automotive industry consider the first American gasoline-engined automobile. Mr. Duryea, you must have a lot of interesting memories.
Yes, plenty. I remember the problems I met building that first car, which Charles and I had discussed since 1888, and the thrill I had when I started that one-cylinder engine and drove America's first gasoline car under its own power. This was September 21st, 1893. No American gasoline car had been driven before that date. Another great memory is the winning of America's first race in my second car on Thanksgiving Day, 1895, in Chicago, 54 miles at 7.5 miles per hour through deep snowdrifts. And 6 months later, winning the country's second race in New York exactly 50 years ago next Thursday. But one of my quaintest memories is only 2 weeks old. A salesman said that if I wanted to buy a new car, I'd have to wait until next year. Perhaps I'd better build one. And now we're all going to start the Golden Jubilee of the great automobile industry in Detroit. I'm looking forward to joining this celebration with Henry Ford, R.E. Olds, my old friend Charles King, and the other old-timers. They put Detroit on wheels, and Detroit has put the rest of the world on wheels.
Thank you, Mr. Duryea.
On March 6, 1896, the stately, wealthy, easygoing city of Detroit was thrown into a mild frenzy.
I think 10 yards of this silk would be just about enough, Mrs. Tramore.
Well, now, will you please bring down that bolt of cloth there on the third shelf? The one with the blue flowers. Yes.
Certainly.
Alice, he's coming!
Now?
Yes, come along.
Well, young lady, where are you going? Come back here.
Oh, excuse me, ma'am.
What's happening? Has everyone gone crazy?
The horseless carriage is coming down the street.
A man named Charles Brady King drove a horseless carriage out of his machine shop on St. Antoine Street, drove down to Jefferson Avenue. There he made a right-hand turn, continued on his route toward the Jefferson House. Detroit has never been the same since.
On June 4th of that same year, from a brick shed at 58 Bagley Avenue, another horseless carriage spluttered forth, and in the driving seat was its builder, Henry Ford. Sure, there were scoffers and doubters, and many just wanted to wait and see what would happen. But so far as the Blue Book Society was concerned, the automobile was in, like Plymouth Rock and Summers in Newport.
The fad grows daily. Nothing that was ever introduced here in Newport has caught the popular fancy as has the automobile.
Colonel Jack Astor, accompanied by Mrs. Landenberg in her Stanhope automobile, decorated with green and white clematis, drove with the same cool-headed dash that distinguished him while serving under fire in Santiago. His example was emulated by Reginald Rogers.
Every large eastern city had its automobile club, and the membership's activities were fully reported in the daily papers.
Owing to several unfortunate mishaps to the mechanism of their machine, Mr. and Mrs. Davis, who left New York City several weeks ago on a trip across the continent, have at last crossed the border into Pennsylvania.
And in Washington, in 1899, the War Department issued a momentous communique.
Three automobiles have been purchased by the War Department for the use of officers. Each is equipped so that a mule may be hitched to it should it refuse to run.
And the war, then, the Department of Agriculture hit a positive and optimistic note.
Flies breed largely in livery stables, but the horse will soon pass, and with it will pass the stable. The coming of the automobile promises a speedy extinction of the house fly.
Whether or not the automobile would effectively eliminate the housefly was a matter of terrific unimportance to the automobile makers of 1900.
Sure, I take off my hat to the European cars. They're fine, handmade jobs, but only the rich can afford them.
Well, then perhaps the automobile will have to remain a luxury, and that's all there is to it.
No, that's wrong, dead wrong. We've got to go about our manufacturing differently, that's all.
All right, then, what's your suggestion?
Quantity production. Not by hand, but by machinery. We'll take the best parts of the European models, and if we can make them by machinery in large quantity, then fine. If not, out they go.
Yes, but that means we won't be making the best automobile.
Maybe not. But listen, man, listen. We can make a machine that will start, go somewhere, and come back. And it will do it with a minimum of mechanical trouble, at small expense, and at a cost that millions of people will be able to buy them.
Yes, but that kind of production means a big factory, maybe as many as 5,000 men eventually.
Of course it does. But if we're going to move out of the stables, if we're going to turn the auto game into an industry, that's the only way to do it.
These were some of the men who set the making of automobiles into the mold of an industry. Pope, Winton, White, Whitney, Prescott, Moon, Pierce, Packard, Ford, Marmon, and the thousands of investors who took a flyer, who said,
"Well, I don't know how it'll go, but it looks like it might. I'll take a chance."
Figures now at hand show that between the 1st of January and the 1st of May, 1899, motor car companies with the enormous aggregate capitalization of more than $388 million have been organized in New York, Boston, Chicago, and Philadelphia. We are on our way now as an industry.
In 1900, for the first time in the history of this business, parts were ordered in 1,000 lots. The Olds Motor Works ordered 2,000 sets of transmission gears from Dodge Brothers, 2,000 motors from Leland Faulkner. Each vehicle sold for $600. From then on, the automobile was no longer the rich man's toy. Instead, it began to become the people's necessity. But within 50 years of the invention of the automobile, 1,000 companies came and went. Some of them were in and out almost in shorter time than it took to crank a 1910 jalopy on a winter morning.
Buy a Buckmobile.
Buy a Buffum.
Buy a Pope Hotfoot.
Rigs that run. A car without a weak spot. No noise but the wind.
Buy a Bates and keep your date.
Buy a Sterk.
Buy a Franklin.
Buy a Waterless Knox.
Buy a Locomobile.
Buy a Doabout. A Bug.
An Imp.
A Kidder.
A Zip.
A Darling.
And they bought. They bought them all. 33,200 in 1906, 43,000 in 1907, 63,000 in 1908, and 124,000 in 1909, 2 million in 1919. And with every car that chugged and sputtered onto the roads, America and its people were changing,
To my mind, the new styles affected by women motorists are disgraceful, particularly when it's remembered that many of these women are mothers.
30% of the unfortunate who have come within the field of the Rescue League's work within the past 2 years have, at one time or another, been automobile riders. This vehicle has an unquestionably demoralizing influence on women.
Tell me, why do you call your wife Automobile?
Because she's always running somebody down.
The new vehicle needed new roads. yet it wasn't until 1916 that Congress passed the Federal Aid Road Act. But in the next 25 years, we made up for lost time to the extent of 1,400,000 miles of highway.
Every mile of highway meant change. The farms were linked to the towns, and the farmer was no longer isolated. The towns were linked to the cities. The filling station replaced the country general store, and the churches moved nearer the highways.
Behind millions of steering wheels, we discovered America. We ate hot dogs on the highways, read jingles on the billboards, bought antique furniture and fresh eggs and vegetables from roadside stands. We spent the nights in auto camps and hotels. We discovered life on the highways, and we discovered crashing and sudden death.
Several years ago, an investigator of social conditions was told by a Midwesterner...
Why on earth do you need to study what's changing this country? I can tell you what's happening in just four letters. A-U-T-O.
To sum up and highlight what the automobile has done to and for the people of America, we now bring to our National Hour microphone Dr. Lee Emerson Dietz, of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, Hunter College, New York.
Some listening now will remember a day, about 40 years ago, when they ran to a rustic highway to see a strange, horseless buggy go by. The road has become a ribbon of concrete, linking far corners of North America. The vehicle was a forerunner of a mass-produced palace on wheels, destined to revolutionize community living. The resultant new mobility ended an era of small community isolation and control and reshuffled trade areas of villages and cities. With truck and tractor, much of northern agriculture became mechanized. Neighbors became citizens of larger publics with wider horizons and greater responsibilities. Around large cities, privately owned homes mushroomed, while traffic congested at the center. In 1939, the automobile was 10 times more deadly than the murderer. Family habits changed. Whole families began going on vacations. The range of mate finding was extended. Courtship was taken out of the parlor. The automobile came to make the fourth largest claim upon the family pocketbook, after food, shelter, and clothing. The caravan of the open road is a cross-section of America on the go. National parks have become truly national, and the public domain has become more public. Unlike the airplane, the wheels of the automobile are on the ground, providing direct contact with sights, sounds, and smells of farms, villages, and city streets. Nor is it like another space shuttler, the through train. Democracy is on wheels, the wheels of auto mobility.
Thank you, Dr. Dietz. The industry that began like a scrubby Cinderella in a small alley shack concentrated and expanded. It concentrated in the city of Detroit, but it also created scores of other businesses in gasoline and rubber, in glass, metal, plastics. These businesses spread through 44 states and a dozen foreign countries. In 50 years, 94 million cars and trucks were built.
In 50 years, about 85 jobs increased to 7 million in the manufacture and sales and servicing of motor vehicles.
In 50 years, automobile factory wages increased from $1 a day to $10 a day. The work week decreased from 66 hours to 44 hours.
In 50 years, the manufacture of automobiles has become a $4 billion industry.
February 10th, 1942, was a very sad day for America.
Hey, Chuck, here she comes.
Yeah. Go ahead, Pete. You drive her out.
It's
funny. All that quiet all of a sudden.
Here's a little kick for good luck, baby.
The last automobile had moved off the assembly line. The industry turned to making the tools of war.
And during the years of war, the automobile companies built 75% of all airplane engines, made one-third of all machine guns.
We turned out two-fifths of all tanks and tank parts, one-half the diesel engines, and 100% of all motorized units.
We were the arsenal of democracy.
And now, 1 year after the war's end, millions of Americans dream and dicker and connive to get a new car. But though the production tap just drips spasmodically, they know that the new cars will come, and they might be made of plastics, of spun glass. They might have seats that open into beds. They might have two-way telephones.
Stop it, mister. You're killing me. All I want is a car. I'll get you an apartment if you can get me a car.
In Flint and Detroit, the automobile manufacturers wait, too, for D-Day, the day when they'll start delivering. And in this year of the industry's golden jubilee, America asks, what do they see for the future? For some of the answers, the National Hour now goes to NBC's affiliated station, WWJ, in Detroit, and to George Romney, General Manager of the Automobile Manufacturers Association.
I hope a lot sooner than production since the war would indicate. About 1 million people already have new cars, and twice that many could have them if we solved the human relations problems of reconversion as easily as we've cleared and reconverted the plants. However, we're now hard at work on the human relations problems. That's really what our big golden jubilee is all about. It's so important that everyone in Detroit and the industry is working together again, and I really believe we're going to continue to work together after it's over. There's a new spirit here, a spirit of let's stop fighting so much about our differences and put more effort into working together on our higher and common interests. This big hats off to the past, coats off to the future affair can help the industry get going and build those new cars so many people need and want. Normally, for every new car sold, 4 or 5 people buy better cars. The sale of a new car sets up a sort of a chain reaction. The new car and most used car buyers turn in used cars. Most people buy used cars, not new cars. I think what most people want is a better car. It may be a year before new cars are plentiful, but Detroit and the auto industry are at last rolling up their sleeves, and we hope our example will help others do the same thing. Our wartime unity of purpose made Detroit the wartime arsenal of democracy. We want it to be the peacetime arsenal of democracy by restoring the unity of purpose that vanished when the war ended. Clearly, peacetime production of goods now is as essential to peace as production of wartime goods was to victory. In Detroit, that unity of purpose is on the way. That means factories will begin to hum and cars begin to roll. Let's all take off our coats and produce the goods needed throughout the world to eliminate starvation and distress that breed revolutions and wars. Let's go to work and build the America we want.
Thank you, Mr. Romney.
On the subject of the 50th anniversary of the automobile, then, our documentary is closed. This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York, Washington, and from station WWJ in Detroit, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 28th of this series on current affairs and national problems. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.